Okay, we're in the final stretch, and we're lucky. So our last speaker is Steve Meister, and we have Nancy Cronin, who is the Executive Director of the Maine Developmental Disabilities Council. Prior to this role, Nancy was the coordinator of the Autism Spectrum Disorder Systems Change Initiative and the State Autism Implementation Grant Coordinator for the Autism Spectrum Disorder Systems Change Initiative and the State Autism Implementation Grant Manager in Maine. She had a big, big job. So I'm going to give them as much time as we can because they have a lot to teach us about transition of care. So without further ado, Steve Meister and Nancy Cronin, thank you so much for being here.
So I'm just going to speak for a minute about, and so that you really know what Nancy did. So we started out, we didn't have any kids getting screened for autism or developmental delay in the state, not formally screened. And so Nancy did a little pilot project with four practices, and she got people to use the PEDS, the ASQ, and the MCHAT, and look to see, could they do it? Would they do it? And we did it. And so we said, okay, now how do we get this to go statewide? And we were lucky enough to get a grant from HRSA for almost about $850,000. And she created this video that was put on MPBN. We went around the state, we did grand rounds. And what we really did was we raised awareness that there was a problem, kids weren't getting screened, and that we could screen. And we started to teach people how to screen, but we really didn't get that far. And then we got the CHIPR grant that Amy is not in the room right now, but Amy Belisle took this and did Breakthrough Collaboratives. Oh, there she is. Yep. So Amy did Breakthrough Collaboratives, and we had dramatic, dramatic returns. So we started on that end, and, you know, on screening and an increasing intervention, and I think I have the numbers right, but Nancy's going to correct me if I'm wrong. We used to be able to diagnose kids at 4 to 5 and intervene at 5 to 6. And now we're diagnosing kids at 2 to 3 and intervening at 3. So it's really a dramatic improvement in care for these kids. Their outcomes are better. The whole thing it's really impressive. I'm very impressed by her. So now we move to the other end of the spectrum. And, you know, I've been taking care of lots of kids with developmental disabilities, and I'm getting older and so are they. And what we, you know, and trying to find providers for kids is a challenge, especially mental health providers. And I've become, you know, I always thought, okay, you know, what I'll do is I'll get the parents to sign the guardianship papers when the kids are 17-ish, and the parents will continue to have guardianship and everything will be fine. But these kids, as they get older, they become more competent. They become better able to make decisions on their own. So we started looking at what's shared guardianship and what does that mean? And boy, parents get really threatened. And, ooh, these kids want to have sex. And, oh boy, that totally freaks out their parents. So Nancy has been helping me to think about this. And there are a couple of programs in the state. So that's really what we're going to start talking about now is, okay, now we've done this, and we've been working with the families. The kids are okay. They're getting close to finishing school. Now what? So there we go.
Thank you. And I'm going to call you up in a little bit to definitely talk about your work. So first, I cannot stay still. Thank you very much. And the very first thing that I want to say is what an amazing presentation we just had before us. That was just unbelievably amazing. And I did the same thing he did. I wrote things down. And the first thing that I want to say is this is an extremely incomplete presentation. The field of emerging adulthood and transitioning to adulthood is brand new. We know that that youth between the ages of 18 and 24, it probably even more, but that's what the studies that I recently read said, that it's the most risky time. Emergency rooms, dangerous things happen between this period of time. And what happens? You're out of the home. and there's less medical care and less continuation of medical care. It's a very, very, very risky time, and we don't think about it. There's conversations that I've read about whether or not transition aid should be its own healthcare specialty, which is interesting and important, and how does it mix? So this presentation is extremely incomplete. It's going to concentrate mostly on folks with developmental disabilities. But I want you to recognize that while I am not an expert in anything, I'm not an expert in autism either. I'm an expert in systems. It's brand new. So let's just go with autism for a little while. So what do we know about developmental disabilities? We know that 1 in 6 people have a developmental disability. We know that they're living. People are living a lot longer than they used to. We know that, according to the CDC, 1 in 68 have autism spectrum disorders. 1 in 150 have chromosomal conditions. We know that we're now looking at things like dementia and early onset dementia and adult issues for people with developmental disabilities. And we never thought of that before because they didn't live. 1 in 323 with cerebral palsy. So let's look at autism. Across the world, there seems to be kind of a stabling off at the rates and prevalence of autism at about 1 in 100. In the United States of America, it still is going up. I don't know why. One reason might be that we define our services based on labels and what that might do. So with that, it seems to be a genuine increase at one point for lots of different reasons, environmental, better knowledge about it, change of the diagnostic, and then it went up, and then it stabilized at about 1 in 100 across the globe, except for in the United States. So what do we have here in Maine? Data is incredibly incomplete, except we have more data than most states. So we look at 2 data sets. We look at IDEA data, so our child find data. How many kids are being identified as being eligible for special education under a category of autism? Does that mean everybody with autism gets special education? Nope. Does that mean everybody with autism gets special education under a specific category? Nope. So that's one. And the other is, who has main care? Does everybody with autism spectrum disorders have main care? Nope. Does the main care data connect with the school data? Nope. So that's what we have. It's still better than most. So what do we know? So I'm going to go kind of quickly. This is in 2010. This is here. What we see is the general population in Maine for students is declining. Autism is still increasing. Now I'm going to go really fast. All I want you to do is look at the slides and look at the slope. I used to call it the autism tsunami. This is 2010. Look at the red. This is today. This is 2014. This is 2016.
So this is 2006 compared to 2016. 2006 is in the blue. 2016 is in the red.
Well, and there's 2010. Look at that arch. Kids were, you know, you could see the peak, were around 8 years old. Today, it's flat. So what we know is kids with autism are growing up and hitting transition age. Main care data, we've got 6,312 individuals in Maine receiving main care of all ages. And just going to go fast to this one. What we know is the fastest growing age groups, not necessarily the ones with the biggest population, but the fastest growing, is in the 18 to 20s. It's actually 21 to 64. Last time I looked at this data 2 years ago, it was 18 to 20. So even here, I'm watching the age. I'm watching my yellow change. All right. Here we go. So I've been doing a lot of studies. 1 second, then I'm giving it back to you. 10 years ago, what did pediatricians say? We've been doing a lot of studies over the last 15 years. Around 2009, I started working on screening for autism spectrum disorders. At the exact same time, I started working on transitioning to adult health care. What you just heard from Dr. Meister is things went well with screening. The fact that I'm having similar conversations today that I did in 2009 means things haven't gone as well in transitioning folks to adult health care. There's more complex. It's much more complex. So 10 years ago, pediatricians said 2/3 reported transition planning should begin between 18 and 20. We now know that that is way too late. 4/5 percent, so we made gains there. Yay, we made gains there. 4/5 perceived that there was a lack of available adult primary care professionals for children and youth with special health care needs. The data is pretty much the same today. 4/5 perceived that there was a lack of available specialists. We haven't gotten that much better. What did adult primary care providers said they wanted? They want a RIN transfer. They want support from a specialist. They want a warm handshake. Okay, I'm gonna move fast because what the Maine Developmental Disabilities Council, I'm the executive director of that organization, did is funded Maine chapter of American Academy of Pediatrics to find out what people wanted today. Then after we go through that, we're going to look at some of the best practices. I'm putting that in quotes because guess what? It changes every minute. And we have to find something that's practical to move the needle. I'm not sure what that is yet. Steve.
Oh, okay. So Deb Hagler started with a focus group in Midcoast, talked to families and providers, and we talked with folks around the state. So we spoke with Carol Hubbard to see what she does with her kids with autism and developmental disabilities. We spoke with the folks at Barbara Bush and what they were doing. I talked with Jonathan Wood up at Eastern Maine. I did a focus group at Maine General. I talked to child psychiatrists, adult psychiatrists, really, you know, just kind of surveying the whole state to find out what people are doing. And it's really a wide range of things. So there is, and I'm going to ignore the slides for a few minutes. There are a number of resources that exist. We spoke with adolescent medicine specialists. We asked them if they had ever heard of GOT Transition, or the Office of Child and Family Services created a tool for transition. And there's another tool that was created by the Elder Services. And they really hadn't heard of any of these resources and didn't use them. We talked with some other folks around the state. They'd heard of some of the resources, but not all of them. So, and then for some that were using, for example, the Office of Child and Family Services program is for schools, it's not that helpful. And people felt, you know, this is a resource, we looked at it, but it didn't really help us. So, God, we have resources, they're not that good. So we need more. When we spoke with adult providers, they said, we don't see a problem with transition. Just send them and we'll take care of them. But you know, adult providers don't manage families the way we do. And my wife is an adult health provider, and people make appointments and she sees them. If people don't come in and they have severe problems, chronic health problems, we call them up, we chase them down. You know, we're much more aggressive in providing care. Our whole office provides care. And families get used to that. Some would say they're spoiled because they're used to really being getting care. But the adult practices don't do the same thing. And I think when you're 35, 40, or 45, that's probably appropriate. But when you're 19 and you have an IQ of, you know, 70, they struggle. And as Nancy was saying, that transition age, They're more likely to get involved with substances. They're more likely to not do things, not follow through. So there are programs in the state that are not about transition to adulthood within healthcare, but about transition to adulthood with everything else. And that's really what's opened my eyes. The big challenge isn't so much finding a doctor, that's something of a challenge, but it's about living independently. So there's a program in Portland that's called StriveU. Has anybody heard of StriveU? Anybody have a patient go to StriveU? I had this kid go, he's an IQ of 65. I said, oh my God, he's gonna live independently? He's done great, absolutely great. He's also, his mother came to visit and she just opened the door and walked in and he was playing air guitar with a body part that she had never seen him do anything like that with before. She called me on the phone and said, does he have some sexual problem? And I said, don't go into his room unannounced, knock on the door. She said, well, I always went in unannounced at home. And I said, well, now he's living independently. So that's another thing that families have to deal with. They have to, these parents have really done amazing work to raise their child to get to this point where they can live somewhat independently. And then when the child is gone, it's so much worse empty nest syndrome than my mother had or we had when our kids left, because they always, you know, kid with severe congenital heart disease and he was blue and he had the surgery and, you know, and he almost died a bunch of times and he's got epilepsy and he's got an IQ of 75 and he can't make change, but he can read and write and he can ride a bus and he's got a job and he wants to live, you know, independently. I have another boy, he's an autism spectrum disorder, and I followed him till he was 19, and he lives in Portland down the block from his mother, and he works at a golf course, and she said, I went into your apartment, and it's a mess, you have to clean it up, and he said, Mom, this shared, you know, guardianship thing, it's going a little far. So, you know, these kids all make gains. I'm watching I have this little boy I follow, he's 14, when he was in sixth grade, he went back to the third grade class and he sat in the third grade class in his old seat. And he did it every day for a few weeks, and his mother brought him in to see me because she didn't know what was wrong. And I said, Mitchell, why are you sitting there? And he said, doesn't hurt there. And I said, it doesn't hurt there? He said, yeah. Didn't hurt my feelings when people laughed at me when I was in, you know, second and third grade. But now that I'm in sixth grade, and he was 14 in sixth grade, it hurts my feelings. So he had this social awakening. I mean, this is actually what we wanted, you know? And his mother cried, and then she laughed. And, you know, we worked through this. We've worked through it with the kids and with the school, so he's not being bullied. But he's also going to have to learn that kids are not always nice, and that's part of growing up. But they grow up. It's not hopeless. I thought that was, God, that was one of the best days. So one of the biggest challenges is finding mental health providers. And I was talking with Janine Taylor, who's a child psychiatrist at Kennebec Behavioral Health. She's now the head of KBH's psychiatry program. And Janine said, Steve, it's not that hard for me to transition them because I have all these adult psychiatrists that are part of my program. So I'm thinking we need to embed this somehow. You know, Lindsay Tweed is a child psychiatrist I work with every day. And in my practice, what I do is I take my little kids when they get to be about, you know, 13 or 14, and Lindsay takes them. And he moves them through later adolescence because he's linked to the adult psychiatrists, and I'm not really. So we're doing, it's easier, I think, to do that. But I keep, sometimes the kids with autism, the parents and the kids don't want to leave me because they're used to me. And so it's hard for me. I have to write these long reports to do the warm handoff. And we don't get paid to do that. We don't get paid any extra. I can't bill a five. It's not even a visit, so I can't bill anything. So that's something for us, I think, to work on going forward. The pediatric cardiologists in Portland and in Lewiston have changed the name of their practice. It's no longer congenital. It's no longer pediatric heart. It's now congenital heart, and they're keeping these kids into adulthood because the adult cardiologists are not comfortable managing congenital heart disease. They're comfortable managing, cardiovascular disease, but not congenital anomalies. What else do we have here? Mental health programs. The folks in Portland put together a whole program with Got Transition, and they worked on it for 5 years, and it was a quality improvement project, and they got everybody to use the Got Transition program, and then the project went away. And what's happened over the last couple of years is people are using it less and less. And it's probably going to disappear. So it's an issue of sustainability. So they showed you could do it. You could put it in. You could start transitioning at 12 and 13. Carol Hubbard does it. She starts transitioning all of her kids at 13. But if you don't have a way to sustain it, it's not going to happen because it takes extra work. We did a survey, 66%, 62 people, 66% of practitioners said that families have approached them asking for help. 57 responded to the question. 81% have initiated transition from a pediatric practice to an adult practice. As you get older, everybody has to do this. 62% face challenges when trying to transition. It was hard to find an adult provider who understood the disorder. So I have a kid with floating harbor syndrome. He's about that tall. He's 18. He had severe congenital heart disease, tetralogy of flow. He just had a valve put in. He's doing much better. Now that he's got blood flow to his brain, his depression is diminishing. His anxiety is less, so he's on less an SSRI. He still has ADHD, so he needs a stimulant. Who's gonna take this boy from me? Lindsay. he has social phobia. And his mother, I love her, but she has a filthy mouth and she's hard to work with. She is, she comes in and says some things and the nurses go, oh my God, get him in Steve's room, close the door, So this is adult providers are not happy about having mothers come in, and you have the issue of guardianship. So they have to apply for guardianship at least 6 months before they turn 18. And if they wait too long, they have problems. One amazing thing that I learned is that all of these kids that I follow who have intellectual challenges, so their IQs are low or they're not capable of making a lot of decisions for themselves, and they all qualify for SSI. So I have kids that are 6 that get SSI, and, they're microcephalic, and some have genetic disorders, microdeletions and microduplications. 2 years after they qualify for SSI, they qualify for Medicare. They're dual eligible. So in some ways, there's greater reimbursement for those kids. For the kids that are aging out, that now are 18, they have to reapply for Medicaid. They can also get Part A and Part B of Medicare. Nobody knows this. So what do we have? 70% didn't know or only somewhat knew best practice methods of treatment and transition. 82% felt that transition is very important, or most of us think it's important. A lot of people were not comfortable with the transition process. And transition goes so much further beyond us transferring care. And that's where I am right now. I'm discovering what's available statewide, and we're going to need to partner with other not-for-profits, and there are a number that provide services to adults if we're going to help our kids. Because here's another story about a boy, 23-year-old, he has Down syndrome. His parents aren't together. He lives with his mom, and she just locks him in the house. And she goes to work, and she locks him in the house. And it's horrible for him. He's watching TV all day, and you can imagine what else he's doing, and it's mostly sexual. And she comes back, and she's very upset about that, and she brings him in to see me and says, what's wrong with him? And I think he's depressed, and she wants an SSRI. And I said, I think he needs to be with people. And we found my practice helped to find a program. And he moved to this young adult sort of communal living, and his depression went away. And he got a girlfriend, and he had sex. And his mother hates me. She still hates me. She still hates me. She works at Maine General. I come in, she looks away. She does not want to. Because I took her best friend. She loved, he's really a lovely person. But he still needs a little Prozac, because he does have a little depression, but it's just a little bit, not the large amount. So he needs a job. Okay, I'm a pediatrician. How am I going to get him a job? How is it? But it's about his health outcomes. So we're going to partner. So we're talking about, what did we do with this grant? We learned about what the families need, what the kids need. We learned there are challenges. We learned that adult providers don't really see that this is a challenge. We learned the families and the kids see this as a challenge. We learned that we need more tools, but we need more than just, the GOT transition tool. Has anybody here tried to use the GOT transition tool? And what do you think? It's pages of little print. I can't do this. It's a lot, building it into a system. If we can, so what we're going to need to do is what we did before. We're going to need to find a...
Yeah, we're going to have to find a simple tool that will work, because as you can see, nothing's worked. So, I mean, basically, and if you don't mind, I'll take it. Yeah. That's okay. So one of the things that I hear a lot is that there's a transition process in schools. It's really important for everybody to know that the law is very, very thorough about transitioning people to adult life in schools. It has everything in it except one thing: health. No, nothing about health. Nothing about health. Here's another thing about it. It has no funding mechanism and no follow-through. So that is a real problem. I'm just going to move. What the DD Council did is we invested in the Maine AAP because we're trying to find something that can be done to improve this system. Because what we find is people grow up, and there's this huge cliff. And the cliff is in a number of things. It's in services. Services, get really weird. It's in the right to continue to develop. For some reason, people think that developmental disabilities or people end at a certain age. It's not true. The development continues until you die. And they fall off on health care. So what is successful transition to adult health care? An informed consumer. A person who knows how to talk to doctors about their history. A person who knows when to call, a person who can communicate where their pain is. A lot of families have talked to me, and I've seen it. The job of a mother, and I will tell you, I'm the mom of a child, of an 8-year-old, who and I have lots of experience. I'm hitting my 50th birthday. And I will say that the hardest job I've ever had is being a mom. I don't know what I'm doing. I can read everything. I've gone to school for a very long time. I've worked in developmental psychology for a very long time, and I don't know what I am doing. But I'll tell you, I want to keep him safe. And I'll tell you something else. His job is to make sure I don't. Because if I prevent him from climbing on the monkey bars and falling off, he'll never know that car surfing is a really stupid idea. Seriously. And what happens with families of parents with developmental disabilities is they become very risk averse because the parent is much more in charge and the individual doesn't say, no, mom. And that's not because you're being bad moms. That's because you're being good moms. It's just it's a different relationship. So how do you teach somebody that? Locating a provider, understanding the needs, knowing how the system works, knowing what benefits. Some of the things the child doctor needs to know where to transition to adult specialty care. What we're finding is doctors don't know that. A list of places to refer to for adult care. We're finding that that's worse. They might know where a specialty care is. They know even less about adult care. Provide anticipatory guidance lists with tickler files. That's great, but got transitions not working. So what kind of things should be in there? Well, a lot of folks with developmental disabilities go to college. A lot of other folks go to college too. You know where they fail? What to do with free time. We overschedule everything to such an extent that as soon as they go to school, they have this free block of time and they don't know what to do. When do you start teaching and transitioning a kid to take their own medications? When do you start talking about sex? You know, on the 25th, the University of Maine at Augusta, we're going to be giving a presentation about sexual abuse in people with developmental disabilities. You know, 85% of adults with developmental disabilities are sexually abused. 85%, NPR just put something on it. And a high percentage are getting in trouble with the correctional system for inappropriately touching other people. And the adult correctional system doesn't know about it. So when are we going to talk about sex? Wow, I'm getting to be a downer. I don't mean to be a downer at the end of the day. Here, yay! Well, sex. These are people. Reimbursement for extra work. Doctors need reimbursement for extra work. Just like they needed reimbursement for doing the MCHAT Part 2, they need reimbursement for this. A warm handshake to adult care, okay? A lot of the pediatricians I see today are doing this, and there's nobody to do it to. So they need the other hand. Understanding about health presentation of individuals, you guys got that. Medical provider relationship, okay. Adult medical doctors, this is the side that we don't know totally what they need to take them. But the relationship with adult doctors is very different. Transition readiness starts at 14. Conduct regular assessments. I don't know what those are yet because they're not practical yet. We got to figure that out. Jointly develop goals with the kids as well as the parents. The whole family. In some ways, I remember I went to my doctor, my child's doctor, and he's not in the room at the moment, but he's so good. And thank God for him because he has to have me as a mother. I have a child of a patient of his. And I said, I don't want him to stop being on the bottle. And he was one. And the doctor looked at me and said, use a cup. And I said, but use a cup. But use a cup. Okay. I did. It was a great idea. I did. It was hard. I needed him to say that to me. Even though I've been presenting and he's in the room sometimes, I needed him to say that to me and be that doctor. We're going to need you guys to talk to families. Let him take his own meds. How are we going to get him to take his own meds? How is he going to know what alarm, what kind of prompt can we use that he's not going to need you, mom, to tell him? Thank you. Okay. Oh. Jiminy. All right. The next little bit is for families. And this is extremely painful. And this is very hard. But what do families need to consider? How do they need to be prepped? Where do they want their kid to live? With them? Somewhere else? We need to look at that. How about employment, recreation, spiritual, guardianship, which we'll talk a little bit. What skills do they need to transition? Calling in a prescription, scheduling appointments, speaking up at the doctor's office. Adult doctors don't act like pediatricians. Make and keep follow-up visits, managing medications. You know, you've got all of this. Personal hygiene, what to do in an emergency. At age 16, contact VR, vocational rehabilitation. You should be looking at transition planning. There's money for that in this state. It doesn't work incredibly well, but it is what we have. At age 17, we should be looking at who's the transition going to be and starting that process. 17 and a half, apply for adult services. Get on the wait list. There's two wait lists. There's four sets of services. There's waiver services. You have to have an IQ of 70 or less. Maine is the most strict criteria. Thank you. Criteria for adult services in anywhere in the nation. We're the hardest to get young children services, and we're the hardest to get older folks services. So you have to have a standard deviation of greater than 70, or I mean less. Yeah, great. Right, 70, not IQ, on an adaptive standard scale.
So they do an ABAS,
right. So you need, to, or a Vineland, that's the one. You want to make sure that the family is getting that before the person turns 18, because they're going to need that to be able to determine whether they're eligible or not. You can stay in the children's systems until you're 21. Or autism.
Although I have a boy with autism and they're not letting him stay.
Let's talk. Because that's not what the law says.
Right,
but sometimes the law doesn't matter. Sometimes misinterpretation changes. And it takes somebody to call and say, hey, did you read this yet? Congratulations to your new job. Did you read this yet? That was a little cynical. Consider what kind of system you want, guardianship, or do you want a supportive decision making? The thing about guardianship, we very quickly go to guardianship, but the problem that happens is moms and dads die. And then what happens when moms and dads die, if it's just a guardianship, is families get into a whole big, I don't know what to do. They think their son or daughter is going to take the guardianship. It might not happen. Sometimes it goes into the state. Things happen that are not that great. So it's not as simple as just saying you need guardianship. And there's other models. If you want to, if a child wants to have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, they cannot have it without a guardian's approval sometimes. If you want them to be able to get a drink out of the refrigerator, providers will say, I need to call your guardian. It's so limited. It's possible that they need financial guardianship and medical guardianship, but they don't need the guardianship over where they live. So what's the most least restrictive that you need? I could present for another 3 hours on this, probably better than now. Waiver services are a non-entitlement program. I can't guarantee they'll get it. A lot of folks don't get it. College bound, some tips. How am I doing on time? I talked about unstructured time. Medications, use a verbal alarm prompt for medication. Start that sooner. If possible, when a kid is 16, plan a public transportation trip to see an aunt. Teach kids to use public transportation. It's really important. Create it so it's safe for them to be successful, and do it when they're still at home. Teach personal hygiene. There's some really kind of disturbing studies that those who are lower functioning, lower IQ, do significantly better in life than folks with autism who are higher IQ, higher functioning. And the reason is we made the assumption that they would be able to figure out all those nonverbal social skills, like when you smell, people don't want you near us. teach those things. Make sure they understand personal hygiene. Make sure we know that it's not okay to hug everybody we want to see. Make sure they know how to date and what to do and how to do that. And how's a doctor going to do that? Well, a doctor can start the questions, because a mom's not going to think it, because a mom is thinking, I love my baby, and my God, they're growing so fast, because they have been. Appropriate coping strategies that can be utilized in most places. So yesterday I came and I sat down and I talked to myself all the time. So I'm narrating out loud everything that I'm thinking. And I sit down next to a psychologist up here. He's not here anymore. And he said, do you narrate all the time? And I said, yes, I do. I pretty much always narrate all the time. Well, what you do if that's becoming a problem in life, now I've earned it. You guys all know me. It's okay. I'm just weird. I'm Nancy. It's fine. I'm accepted. But what would be helpful to a college student or a high school student is make sure they have a Bluetooth around. Everybody just thinks they're talking on the phone. Yeah, you know, there are ways to do this. You need social stories? Use the iPad. Everybody's looking at the smartphones anyways. There's so much that can be done to keep you. Use whatever you need into logical things that other people aren't going to see. Yeah, it would be nice if they knew how to do laundry and money. All right. Well, that was fast.
I wanted to. So Carol Mansfield and Ellen Gellerstadt both told me that they use the social worker from the hospital. And so it helps them tremendously. And so I spoke with the social worker. The social workers don't know all of these things. So there's, I think it's critical to use whatever resources you can find that are available. And you need to partner. I can't do this by myself. So I partner with Lindsay for Kids. I partner with a lot of the psychologists in our program, our social workers. I get help wherever I can to help these families to transition. And I think we don't have enough resources in the state. And you guys can't solve that problem, but people who do systems change can, and the chapter can partner. And so that's something that we're talking about doing as we go forward, because this is a big issue coming up.
Yeah. Novel ideas, $10,000 that could be solved with a $10,000 grant, call us. I want to spend it. Yeah.
Wants to know, you know, this kid needs to be able to do healthy shopping, healthy cooking. This kiddo needs to be able to identify where are recreational resources so they can be physically active in their community. This kiddo needs to understand his diagnosis be able to take his meds at school.
No, that's a fantastic idea, is to utilize the transition plan, but there's that's in schools. But how I was fascinated by how Dr. Hagler introduced and started this conference. She said, please understand that doctors cannot tell schools. There's this prickliness at schools still with doctors. So taking your exact idea, Diane, use the Section 28 transition plans. Use the transition plans you've got in Medicaid that they're getting in Section 20 or Section 65, use those to be able to teach. And use the case managers, because medical doctors can direct them and tell them what to do, where they can't tell the schools. And there was another couple more. Go for it.
I actually have two questions for you. So one is, with this whole, obviously for the history of time, there's been major cultural differences between kind of adult healthcare and pediatric healthcare, right?
Yes.
And then there's all these other shifts and transitions that have happened culturally within, you know, over the last 10 years especially, most of which has been addressed, a lot of those issues have been addressed at the conference. So my question is, are we as a as a chapter, do you guys work proactively with, like, the, you know, the internal medicine, you know, the AMA or those chapters, either locally or in Maine or nationally, to move that culture along to kind of...
Do you want it or shall I?
Okay.
I don't know, not as much as we want. The role of the Maine Developmental Disability Council is a systems change activity organization. We work for issues around birth to the grave on systems change. The most receptive group for transition has been AAP. When I go nationally, I think a number of you went back there. I am the Learn the Signs Act Early Ambassador for the state of Maine. I go to the CDC all the time to get updated. And with my ambassador partners across the country, I hear it's the pediatricians in which you can walk in. The internists and the family practice, the internists and the family practice docs, it's harder to crack.
They also feel, you know, and so I talked to a number of family physicians, and they said, we don't need to transition. They're in our office. And they'll see teenagers who, you know, they'll see a 16-year-old. You know, this isn't fair. But it's not unusual for a family physician to see a 16-year-old who's sexually active and once a year. And they're on birth control. Now, we know that if they're sexually active, they should have a chlamydia test every 6 months. But they're not told to come back in 6 months. They just see them once a year, and they get a prescription for their birth control for the year. So, and I know this because I see the kids when they come into foster care and they're 14 and they're sexually active and they're on birth control and they're going in once a year. These are high-risk kids. So I think that there is an assumption that people will come in when they need to come in. And we used to be, I think, more that way. We're less so now. So, and I think it's partly Bright Futures, which is scripted, you know, what we're supposed to do at certain ages in certain places, including adolescents. So that's one of the challenges. The big challenge for me is with kids with developmental disabilities and finding an adult mental health provider who's going to write the prescriptions that the kids really do need as adults. And they end up getting off the medications pretty quickly if they're not followed by a mental health provider. Deb.
I just was going to make, Nancy, what I've discovered in the Mid-Coast area, I think I can project, I'll try.
Can I take
is that many of the kids with developmental disabilities were getting referred to a cadre of adult providers whose children had developmental disabilities themselves.
Yeah.
So they were feeling comfortable embracing that population. Now they're starting to get really overwhelmed, but yeah. In my head I'm wondering, you know, I don't know what to make of that, but they have a sensitivity to the issue and to those families because they themselves are a family that works with pediatricians in a different way. Like they're in our office all the time.
We should let Scott, because he's an adult provider.
Oh, good.
Patients. I'm a general internist. I don't see kids full-time anymore. I don't see kids actually professionally much at all. But we sometimes we set up expectations, both of the patient and their parents. So the kid with tetralogy that's doing well may not need to see the pediatric cardiologist except once or twice during the transition.
Right.
And if I'm the accepting family doctor internist, as long as I know that I can call his pediatrician at Children's or at Maine, I'm good with that. I'm personally good with that. But that's a thing that has to be a cultural change, and it has to be over time. And I don't mean 30 days or a 90-day billable bundled charge. It's a cultural change for the hospital, the school, and our residency programs are going to have to do a better job at transitioning. The biggest problems for transitionals in my world is a patient leaving a hospital and going to a nursing home or not. But it's the same issue. You're dealing with their parents sometimes. We're not going to change it overnight. But if we If a good generalist is comfortable with the mental health issues or the cardiac issue or the muscular dystrophy, which is the cases I had for whatever reason in Tallahassee, I had two of them, and they did fine, but the pediatrician held on to her until they were 22. And
they don't get more.
Right, and that was great for me because I was able to, you know, make sure that the parental handoff was good and you know, it's the spectrum of the system we built, and we're struggling with it.
Yeah.
It's not going to be easy in Maine because you're never going to have more than three pediatric ophthalmologists. You're never going to have.
Can I say something real quick?
Well, Jen wanted to make a comment.
I know, but before the topic changes too much.
We need payment for collateral contact. We need some kind of system for experts for conversations, and I don't know what that looks like. We need echo. We absolutely do. Yeah. Twenty-one versus 29, 65. So you just had Maine Parent Federation speak to you yesterday, and we're funding a grant with them. So the first thing they're actually. They're getting me the quote. It's a longitudinal grant. I want to fund 5 to 10 years in which they pick 5 to 10 to 20 or whatever they say they can handle families. Start at 14. Start with self-determination. Start with learning all those things and guiding through the transition process, teaching choices, all of that. But so they know all of those things. And then we'll figure out how do we extend that to other people. It's just simply, in some ways, I see families, they're just overwhelmed with the current crisis of the moment, and there always is one, and then all of a sudden, it's the day before their 18th birthday, and what do you mean I'm supposed to get guardianship, and everybody's saying guardianship, but I don't even have time to process that, and oaths, and Section 21 and 29, and wait a second, yeah, it's not fair. University of Maine at Orono, they said no to a grant for that. No offense to the University of Maine at Orono. I teach at Kennebec Valley Community College, and I just got the request from other professors to do an in-service of how do you work and how do you teach people with autism, because we have a lot of folks with autism, and the doctors don't even know the professors don't know how to do it successfully. This is emerging, like emerging transition. This whole construct is new. So my last plug, and then I'll go away. And
thank you.
I don't know what to do. The council does not know what to do about transition to adult health care. But we want to do something. And we don't have a lot of money, but we have $10,000 to $20,000 every year. So if you have an idea, will you tell me? And if it's something that we can scale down to small enough that $10,000 or $20,000 will pay for it, then we're in. But it can't come from my brain because my brain is trying, but I seem to be doing the same things over and over again. And what did Einstein say about that? So it's not working. So to solve and fix this, I need everybody's talent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. All right, so quickly, let's see, what did we do? Dr. Rady told us to exercise your body, do something fun, get connected, exercise your brain, and play. Michelle Abbott taught us that concussions are bad for your brain, but complete rest doesn't help, and a gradual return to play is best. So don't forget to play. Deb Hagler showed us that drugs and alcohol are bad for children's brains. Get them to delay substance use to 21, and they're less likely to have substance abuse problems. And let's join Deb in using Espert. Guy Cousins from MMA talked to us about when it comes to drug and alcohol abuse, physician, heal thyself, but call the MPHP program first. And there's the number, and so this hopefully will go on the on our program website. Jeff Stone promoted preventative dental care in the office, an oral health exam, and fluoride gel application. And you get a 40% reduction in cavities. Jeff Berman, and there was an ophthalmology update. Amblyopia is preventable, screen for vision problems, and photoscreen young kids. Kelly Bowden and perinatal care, PQC for me, quality collaborative. And this is actually really important to me because I was on the child death review panel. I was the chair when we were asked by Brenda Harvey to look at home births and whether they were safe in Maine. And it was shocking. They are not safe in Maine. And they're not safe in Maine because the midwives were choosing to do high-risk births because they didn't know the difference between low-risk and high-risk. And it's because they weren't trained well enough. So we now have improved in coordinated care. So this is a great thing. And they're going to have better training requirements for licensing. And then the next is replace the Finnegan score with Eat Sleep Console Tool, ESC. Lucian Gonzalez, teens and substance abuse, providing care is important and matters. Get past stigma and out of silos. And who is not in the room that should be? And Espert, equip, and data. And Senator Rebecca Millett, our legislator of the year, has been working on environmental health, mental health, and education. And I'm going to ask the physicians and others that remain in the room to be available to us if we need people to testify, because it really makes a difference when a pediatrician shows up and takes the time and stands up and gives a 3-minute presentation. It changes the course of what will happen in our state government. And Nancy Cronin and the tsunami of kids with developmental disabilities, so many kids to transition, where will they go? And this is just the beginning. So thank you all for coming and caring for children and teens in Maine. Have fun, exercise, and we'll see you next year.